And good morning. Welcome to Cool Science Radio. Science and technology in a complicated world that's interesting, fun, and understandable. I'm John Wells. I'm here with my co-host, Lynn Ware Peak. We have an interesting show for you this morning. Our first guest, Mark Hurst, Executive Vice President of Tempus Global Data. In a very recent announcement, just a couple days ago, Tempus will build and operate a constellation of hyperspectral, and fear not my Cool Science Radio base, we will figure out what that word means, hyperspectral imaging and sounding systems that will enable the company to deliver next-generation weather data to commercial government customers worldwide. And if that wasn't enough, Tempus will provide this critical weather data through the use of the Utah State University built and designed sounding and tracking observatory.
That's right. Another great scientific exploratory bit of technology that Utah State University created, which I think is, we're always discovering new things. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Lynn.
Nice to see you. Our second guest this morning is Alain Guy, if I said that even close to correctly, digital security expert and CEO of the Swiss company GlobeX Data. Alain will be on the phone from Switzerland to tell us why everyday Americans should care about their online security. Although most of us hear about security breaches on a constant basis, a huge percentage of Americans are not doing enough, if anything at all, to protect themselves. The prevailing thinking among many seems to be, with so many people in the world, really, what are the odds that I'll become a victim? Alain will be with us to tell us why we should care and what steps we can take to protect ourselves.
These two guests plus today's cool story when we return. You're listening to Cool Science Radio, only in Park City, only on KPCW.
This is Sandra Vogt. Join us for the Park City 2014 Luxury Home Tour. Saturday, August 9th, 8:30 a.m. to 6 p.m., 5 private homes the colony will open their doors for one day. $60 in advance, $65 at the door. Tour includes live music from Austin Wolf from American Idol, barbecue lunch, and transportation. Tickets at theluxuryhometour.org. Park City Board of Realtors Philanthropic Foundation is a nonprofit organization.
Nexus IT is proud to have supported KPCW for the past 10 years. Nexus IT provides on-premise and cloud voice over IP, phone systems, and service that simplify and unify your business telecommunications. 435-487-9099, nexusitc.net.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm John Wells. I'm here with my co-host, Lynn Ware Peak. We love to talk about the weather on Cool Science Radio. Recently, we had the program manager from NASA's GPM, Global Positioning Management Satellite, a very capable, sophisticated satellite, among other things, can take a CAT scan of hurricanes. We've had a geologist that could tell us what to expect for future weather by looking many years into the past. And we've had a number of meteorologists to discuss extreme weather. Today, our guest is Mark Hurst, Executive Vice President of Tempus Global Data. Tempus will build and operate hyperspectral imaging and sounding systems that will enable the company to deliver next-generation weather data. They will do this through the use of the Utah State University-built sounding and tracking observatory. Mark, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Actually, I think we have Scott Jensen. Oh, just got a note in. Is that Professor Scott Jensen?
Yes, you got Scott on the line. I'm from Utah State University.
Hello, Scott.
Weather Systems Foundation. How are you this morning?
Okay.
Oh, well, we're having technical challenges. Must be the satellite.
Well, we thought you might be joining us, Scott, and we're actually pleased that you are, because you're kind of the science behind this, and that, and so you're the one who can really decipher for us lay people exactly how we're going to read the weather this way.
Well, certainly interesting scientists, no doubt. Interesting science, no doubt.
Yes, absolutely. Well, why don't we start with this? If you can take us through how the history of how weather has been monitored over time, because now we're getting all of these very high-tech types of monitoring systems, as JW was saying, that we spoke with NASA about their global precipitation measurement, which is taking sort of cross sections of something, you know, like a hurricane, being able to see it with much more precision. And you've got the storm system. So how did we get to this place? Where did we come from with being able to see weather?
Yeah, well, a lot of, you know, weather started long ago by looking, you know, basically up into the sky and saying, what does it look like? Are we having a clear, nice day? Does there look like there's clouds forming in the western sky? And maybe it's going to rain. We talk about the harvest moon, and I think we've all heard those, you know, those analogies and terminologies. You know, today we still use a lot of very simple, basic, method in making weather measurements. The United States Weather Agency still rely heavily on commercial airliners to report back temperature and wind from their flight path. You know, ships that sail the oceans have basic temperature and weather monitoring capabilities on them that.
Did we lose you there? Do we have you there, Scott? Can't hear a thing from you. Okay, we're going to try to get Scott Jensen back on the line. We'll go to a word from our underwriters. We'll be right back. You're listening to Cool Science Radio.
This is Steve Roney with Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties, formerly Prudential, Utah. We continue to be proud supporters of KPCW and are excited to embark on the next era of Park City real estate under our new brand. More info at bhhsutah.com.
This is Michelle from Peak Art and Frame, proud supporters of KPCW. Locally owned and operated, Peak Art and Frame features local photography and artwork, as well as digital printing, custom framing, and mirrors. Open 7 days a week, rush service available, located in the Walmart Shopping Center, 649-0801, peakartandframe.com.
Hi, I'm Kelly from San Francisco Design, longtime supporter of KPCW. We provide a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. Our showrooms are in Park City and Salt Lake, and both offer complete design services. We're on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
Hi, I'm Amy Roberts with Park City Medical Center, a nonprofit community hospital. Did you know Summit County has the highest rate of breast cancer in Utah? It's an alarming statistic, but one that can be changed with early detection. Mammograms save lives, and at Park City Medical Center, our team of skilled experts use the latest technology for the most accurate reading. We also offer soft robes, a private women's only center, and a special cushion called a mammopad to help make mammograms more comfortable. Call 658-7051 to schedule your mammogram today. It's a call that could save your life.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak here with John Wells. We were speaking with Professor Scott Jensen, professor at Utah State University, and we're hoping that we've got him back on the line. Do we have you there, Scott?
You have me. We can certainly study weather, but cell phones is another technology.
That's right. That's right. Well, let's go ahead and try to get back to the weather. And you were talking about sort of the history of how we have the diagnostic history of how we've looked at weather and how we've made predictions, beginning with just simply going up in aircraft and flying into a hurricane and taking data that way, on up to what you've developed at Utah State University. So I'm not sure where we lost you in there, but why don't you go ahead and continue?
Yeah, sure. So basically, just to recap, you know, weather observations can be made through visible observations, which is just simply by looking and seeing what you see in the weather, to basic temperature monitoring capabilities that exist in the world today, whether it's just a temperature sensor, you know, sitting next to a house, maybe somebody has put a rain gauge in their backyard,
aircraft and ships that travel the world have basic weather monitoring capabilities on them, and they'll report back to, you know, the governments of the world as they're flying over a certain area what the weather in those areas is doing. And so even in this modern day of some pretty high-tech technology, we still use very basic means for monitoring, reporting the weather. The United States government has some capabilities that are on orbit. They're satellite-based technologies. Some are in low Earth orbit, which is about 300 miles or so above the Earth, and others are in what we call a geosynchronous or geostationary orbit. They're about 22,000 miles above the Earth's surface. A satellite that's in the low Earth orbit, one of your previous guests may have talked about, takes kind of a CAT scan of the atmosphere, if you will. That satellite, there's an instrument on it called the Crosstrack Infrared Spectrometer that does that sort of science, takes a very detailed picture of the atmosphere, and from that, very smart people that have great math backgrounds and love to do math, crunch the numbers, and they're able to come up with wind vectors and precipitation predictions and temperature predictions, those sort of things. And then out at geostationary or geosynchronous altitudes, we have what we call the GOES satellites, and those take the pictures that we see largely on our nightly newscasts. When you see the picture of the clouds, going over the United States or over Utah or wherever it might be, when you see the pictures of the hurricanes, those are usually coming from the geosynchronous satellite, and that gives us a way to monitor cloud movement on a lot larger scale.
Scott, I'm curious. When you talk about a geostationary orbit 22,000 miles above the Earth and the satellite is constantly focused on a predetermined spot, how does it maintain that location?
Just so happens that the speed of the satellite, the orbiting speed of the satellite, matches exactly the rotation of the Earth. So when we launch these satellites and it is set to, let's say the location of that satellite is set to be over Park City, Utah, over the equatorial plane, it's got to be over the equator, then it will basically stay fundamentally right over Park City, Utah. So if you're able to look up in the night sky and somehow see that satellite with your eyes, you would always see it located in the same point in the sky all the time, whether it was day or night.
And because it's 22,000 miles, or because it's 22,000 miles above the Earth, it's able to do that. If it was less or if it was more, its speed would not be in sync with the Earth's rotation.
That's correct. So the speed of the satellite matches basically the rotational speed of the Earth, and so the two points, if you will, the point on the ground and the point in the sky, remain in the same position with respect to each other.
Now, Scott, we're talking about weather, we're talking about technology, but we're also talking about a very unique business model. And now it's been done before, but it's fascinating. And that's that Tempus utilizes a model that provides all of this sophisticated weather data to its clients, who now do not have to take the risk of building, launching, servicing their own assets in orbit. How long has this business model been used in this type of business?
Actually, it's fairly new. A good example of how this business model has been used in other industries would be a company or a few companies that you may have heard of called Digital Globe and GOI. If you've ever had a chance to get on Google Earth or view Google Streets or any of those online mapping programs, you've probably seen pictures taken from those companies. Those companies are, in fact, commercial companies that have taken data and sold that data to not only commercial entities but government entities for use for their purposes. Now, in the case of Google, because it's a visible imager, meaning it takes pictures of things that we can see with our eyes, it can take pictures down to the level that, you know, the military is extremely curious about. So there's only a certain level of picture that the government will allow commercial companies to share with the public, and a certain level of detail of picture that then the military will use for their purposes.
Scott, I'm wondering, as technology advances and you're developing these very precise weather and precipitation measurement devices, are you finding that there are more applications for it, and this is how the private sector is coming in and possibly even funding more and greater research?
Absolutely. You know, if you look at how our markets, how our daily lives are affected by not understanding the weather, when you sit down and start thinking about all the different examples that we could share with you, they're numerous. But, you know, let's take just a few of the examples that in recent past that you may have remembered. Hurricane Sandy, for example, that, you know, the landfall was, you know, never completely predicted correctly and ended up costing a lot of our government a lot of evacuation money in areas that never ended up having to be evacuated because our landfall predictions for that model, that hurricane, were not accurate. Moore, Oklahoma, the residents in Moore, Oklahoma had about 15 minutes notice of the tornado that hit that area. And what just broke my heart, especially knowing that you know, we have this technology today that can see these tornadoes forming hours in advance, knowing that, you know, the school districts back there were making decisions on, you know, whether to send kids home, not send kids home, and so they put them all in the middle of a gymnasium, and the tornado hit that school dead center. We just know we can do better. Back in Joplin, Missouri, when that big tornado hit back there, some of those residents had 3 minutes warning, some had 15 minutes warning, some had no warning, you know, until they saw the tornado. And so, you know, we look at this sort of technology that's available today to make significant impacts, not only on severe weather, like, you know, hurricane landfall, tornadoes, where they're going to form, but just on your everyday life type of things. Should airlines fly at 36,000 feet instead of 38,000 feet to save money on fuel?
Right.
UPS and FedEx, should they be, routing down I-80 today instead of I-70 because of winds and potential road closures?
That's, very interesting, very creative, new. You know, I'm wondering, before we get too far away from the recent tornadoes, when there's so much really tragic loss of life and property, I'm wondering, the technology exists, but where's the void there? Where's the gap? Is it a gap in time that technology can be implemented so that we do know hours ahead of time that a tornado or a hurricane will strike?
Well, right now the gap is just flat out in technology, to be, you know, very honest with you. We see tornadoes forming by using what we like to call right now type of technology, or Doppler radar. Mm-hmm. Doppler radar tells you what's happening. They're ground-based systems. They tell you what's happening in the sky right now. We also use predictive tools from our satellite products that are on orbit, but those are you know, significantly older technology, and we just don't have great models that correlate with the data that comes down from those satellites. And so, to give you an example, the technology that the U.S. government is going to launch in 2017 is called GOES-R. It's going to have an instrument on the on that sensor that is called ABI. It stands for Advanced Baseline Imager. This storm sensor, now ABI would have seen a convective severe tornado event over northern Texas about 3 hours sooner than Doppler radar would see it, which is good compared to what our current state-of-the-art technology is. But the sensor that we're working on in Utah State called STORM would actually see that same event almost 8 hours before Doppler radar sees the event show up.
Wow.
And so Scott, let's just take a time out for a second because we have a lot of acronyms on this show. STORM is Utah State University's, and here's the acronym, what it stands for, Sounding and Tracking Observatory for Regional Meteorology.
Correct.
Okay, so we want to make sure we define that. We also would like to take a moment, and we would like to define hyperspectral imaging.
Yeah, hyperspectral imaging is just a way to say, maybe in layman's terms, it's like HD TV compared to your, you know, the TV we had 30 years ago.
Right.
Hyperspectral, instead of discrete bands, so the Advanced Baseline Imager, or ABI, that the government will launch in 2017, uses, I believe, on the order of 32 discrete bands, so it can see 32 discrete colors. Hyperspectral just means multiple colors in between a set of bands. So
it's higher granularity for analyzing data.
Much higher granularity. So STORM will see 1,800 bands.
Okay.
In between the same starting and ending points, if you will, on the light spectrum.
Scott, I'm curious. The visual spectrum is so small.
Yes.
What percentage of weather assets that are up in the sky are in this narrow visual spectrum, analyzing that data, versus all of the other pieces of the spectrum, which are so rich and robust?
Yeah. Well, you know, that's a great question. I don't know the exact answer for you. I can tell you that most of the weather assets that we're putting up are visible type assets. ABI has a suite of visible sensors on it. They do also have some bands that cover the infrared bands, but they're discrete bands. They're not hyperspectral bands. Some of the older DOES instruments largely had visible bands. They also had a few bands that covered the infrared spectrum. And then some of the low Earth orbiting satellites, the ones that orbit the poles, one in particular called the Joint Polar Satellite System that was launched a few years ago. It has, in fact, a hyperspectral sounder on it called CRIS, but it also has visible bands on it as well. So there is a mixture. I'm not sure what the percentage is, but certainly most of our weather observations at this point from satellites tend to be visible in nature.
Mm. If you're just joining us, our guest is Professor Scott Jensen from Utah State University. Professor Jensen has worked with the STORM instrument, Sounding and Tracking Observatory for Regional Meteorology. And Scott, want to ask you sort of, I'm interested in these public-private partnerships, if you will. I'm not sure that if that's what you call them, but I want to know how the process works. So Utah State University has developed this instrument, and you are then working with a private corporation, Tempus Global Data. And how does that relationship work? Are you selling the technology?
Yeah, so what happens is this technology was initially developed by the U.S. government. The U.S. government back in 2000 put money into hyperspectral sounding, which the STORM instrument is part of that technology. In about the 2004-2005 time frame, the U.S. government got into some financial troubles with the Iraq War and other budgetary problems that caused them to cut back their space budgets, and that technology was abandoned, even though at that point the progress being made on the technology was excellent. The government does have a mechanism to take IP, that intellectual property that it has developed, and basically allow the private industry or commercial companies to take that IP and use it for continue to develop it, and then use it for purposes that the technology was initially defined for.
Mm-hmm.
The caveat being is if you go back and the government wants to be a purchaser of some of that data that you're going to procure, or some of the imagery that you're going to take, if they want to purchase that data, that you'll give them essentially the best price that's available on the market for that imagery.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So it's a way that the government allows the technology not to die, allow the private industry to do something with it, and not rot on the shelf.
Yes, exactly. And then getting a license to put, to actually implement the technology. So Tempest Global Data recently, in the last couple days or week, got a licensing agreement with NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, to go ahead and build and operate the system. So is that, does it have to be technology that's so well developed and so foolproof at the point that NOAA would give you the license? I mean, obviously they're not licensing all kinds of systems.
That's correct. That's exactly right. We did just receive our license, and NOAA is not going to grant a license on an application that says, for example, we want to take pictures of the Earth. We have to tell NOAA exactly how we're going to take pictures of the Earth, in what bands we're going to take pictures of the Earth, how often we are going to take the pictures of the Earth, what it's going to be used for, what countries of the world the data might be sold to. Interestingly enough, there's some pretty severe limitations on what sort of pictures you can take over Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And they make sure that you're not violating, international treaties that have been set up and agreed to in that regard.
Hey, Scott, we're just about running out of time. We only have about a minute left, and I'm going to ask you a tough question. This is a tough question because we could probably talk about it for several hours, so you're going to have to give it to us in like 30 or 45 seconds. That's why it's
okay.
So tough. It's going to be tough. So we all went to high school, physics, and, the little classes that taught us that our electromagnetic field would protect us from solar flares. However, we also know that in 2012, a giant plume shot towards the Earth and missed the Earth. But they are saying if it had hit the Earth, we would have been protected. Human life would be fine. However, it was possible that satellites and transformers on the planet itself could have been affected and knocked out. Is that true, or is this some sort of hype that I read?
No, that is completely true. Satellites and electronic devices are susceptible to what we call electromagnetic interference or electromagnetic radiation. And it comes at us in a number of different wavelengths, if you will. Some electronics are more sensitive to different types of wavelengths than others. But what the space industry does very well, because we know this exists, there's something called the Van Allen Belt that is a very high radiation environment for satellites,
right,
that's around the Earth. So we design for that. We design to encounter solar flares. We design to fly through these radiation belts that are around the Earth.
This plume had hit us in 2012, it could have been disastrous.
I would say most of the satellites had capabilities to turn themselves in a way to provide enough shielding to protect the electronics. Could we have had more damage than we did? Absolutely. But good, you know, based on good designing, good engineering, a lot of those things were able to mitigate most of the events. Not all, but most.
Well, this is a great conversation. A couple of reasons. One is we love Utah State University, and the second is we love to talk about weather on Cool Science Radio. So we want to thank you for joining us.
Call back anytime.
Well, that sounds great. Thank you so much for joining us, the Scott Jensen, Utah State University. And
thanks, Scott.
So we want to thank you. Up next, Alain Ghia, digital security expert and CEO of the Swiss company Globe X Data. We're going to talk to Elaine about what steps can be taken to protect our online security. You're listening to Cool Science Radio, only in Park City, only on KPCW.
Support for KPCW comes from Wasatch Brew Pub, offering brunch on the patio at the top of Main every Saturday and Sunday, including New York steak and eggs, Wasatch waffles, and French toast, as well as Midday Marys and mimosas. Private event space available. Wasatch Brew Pub, misbehaving in Utah since 1986. WasatchBeers.com.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak here with John Wells. We were just talking with Scott Jensen, professor at Utah State University, about the Tempest Global Data partnering with Utah State University in some new weather exploration. Well, every day there seems to be another story about a major breach of security where credit card and personal information of countless people has been stolen or someone's ATM card has been hacked. Our next guest is Alain Ghiai, digital security expert and CEO of the Swiss company Globe X Data. Alain will be on the phone from Switzerland to tell us what we as individuals can do about it. Alain Ghiai, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you, Lynn. Thank you, John.
Well, it's nice to have you. Why don't we start with this? Just how compromised are we? For those of us who really who are the people who say I could never be a victim, there's so many numbers out there. Just the average, you know, user of a computer with our various passwords. How compromised are we?
Well, first of all, we always think it will never happen to us, but it's Murphy's Law. It's going to happen. It's like any tragedy. If you think an earthquake is not going to come in your area and it does, or you're not going to be robbed and you get robbed, it's the one in a million chance, except that in the hacking industry, the odds are much higher. Especially in the U.S., we are very vulnerable because the U.S. ranks as one of the highest risk countries for internet security. And by that, I mean that the U.S., along with Canada and a couple other countries are, let's say, on the top five list of countries to hack, mostly from Asia, Eastern Europe. Why? Because we hold a lot of valuable data. So we are at very high risk, and we underestimate this risk on a daily basis. And we also underestimate the value of the data that we hold, whether it's it's our credit card information, our financial, our medical information. So we are at high risk. We just underestimated a lot.
Well, that's funny because as soon as you said we have so much valuable data in this country, my immediate knee-jerk reaction is I don't have valuable data, really. You know, I think of if my credit card is hacked, somehow I can recover that from the credit card company. But this obviously is the fallacy of thought.
Yes, it is. Let's talk about the credit card. I'm not sure on a debit card if you're covered as well. But
I think the debit card is our largest exposure.
Yes. The debit card, I was compromised in my debit card. I spent some time in New York because we have our U.S. offices there too. I was compromised on my debit card. Now, the bank was nice enough to refund me because the compromise was so obvious. But let's say somebody steals your credit card information and you're only liable for the $50 or what have you that the credit card will make you liable for. It's not just a financial loss that either you or the financial institution will have, which at the end we all pay for with interest charges and what have you. But it's also now they have your identity. Mm-hmm. So identities can be purchased for as little as $5 or $10 in the underworld of hackers. And with that, they have your address suddenly. They have your social security. So let's say your credit card will be replaced and you have no financial liability. Your social security, your address, and tons of other information is not available to these hackers. You know, in the old days, there used to be mail fraud where people used to go to mailboxes and steal mm-hmm. people's checks. Now it's digital information that's being stolen. Now we can do things to prevent that as much as we can, but we do have valuable data. I'd like to say one more thing. I encounter a lot of people that say, "I don't have anything valuable." Well, whether it's the picture of a child or your tax return, they're both equally valuable. And let me explain to you, if you have family photos or picture of children underage and you don't want them to pop up in some adult website in one of these countries that promote those things, because that's a violation of more than property. That's your whole identity, your persona that's being violated. So people steal everything, mm-hmm. images, photos, information about your medical history, financial information. That it's important to protect it.
Alan, one of the other challenges I would believe would be that in this country, say the average person has a couple credit cards, maybe a relationship with Amazon online or Overstock.com mm-hmm. or several others, and if your credit card information is compromised, then also your PIN number. And it might be a password that you also use, or you use a derivative of that password for your other accounts. So now the hacker is able to get in to all of your different accounts. And as far as the security question, for an example, if you use your mother's maiden name or your first dog or your first school, chances are you're using the same security question for your other accounts. So They can get anywhere at that point.
That's very true. That's a really good point, because I was going to suggest maybe a couple ways where we can minimize that threat to us. So if I may,
do not
log into a website, a secure site. Let's talk about an Amazon or an Expedia or your e-banking, for example, or paying your phone bill online. Do not log into those sites from a Wi-Fi hotspot. Those free Wi-Fi hotspots are unsecure. Mm-hmm. I would recommend that you log in from your home,
right,
if possible, from a directly connected line, or at least a password-protected Wi-Fi network. That's, let's say, the top of the pyramid. Is you try to use a network that is secure. Then under that, you have the password, which is basically the nerve center of everything that we do, because we log in with passwords everywhere we go, whether it's on Facebook or Twitter or paying bills online. In order to create complex passwords, and I don't think anybody can create so many complex passwords and remember them, I would recommend that you use a password manager. There are many companies that provide that. This is a service that we provide at Digital Safe too, among others. And how the password manager works is you basically go to a site, you pay for it most of the time, and then you click a button and it'll create a complex password for you. Because a password needs to be, at bare minimum, 6 characters long. It needs to have an uppercase and a lowercase letter. It should have a number and a punctuation, at least. And the passwords should be changed every 90 days. And you should have a different password for everything. I have over 200 passwords, and it adds up really quickly. If you travel, you have your mileage bank with airlines. You have your hotel points, a rewards card. I'm not even going to talk about credit cards and debit cards. You have your e-banking. You have all the services that you purchase, whether it's a gym membership you're going to pay, your phone bill or cable bill. You go online and pay for everything that we do today requires a password, because we just do everything on a digital world. So the password is critical. You know what? One of the advantages that we have, of course, is that we're storing all your data in Switzerland. That's another layer of, let's say, privacy that most sites don't have. But at least if you go to a good password manager or a data backup system that would have that as well, it makes your life a lot easier. So the password is, I'd say, the most important. And then on top of that, when you log into to your website, if you go via a phone or a laptop and you're in a public place, I would recommend you protect that screen just as much as if you were going to an ATM machine and get cash. You definitely will try to protect your PIN code, and you don't want somebody behind you to see how much you're taking from your account, right? Mm-hmm. The same thing goes with logging in on screens if you have people around you.
Right. That's a pretty simple thing. Alain, I have a couple of questions that have come up since you've been speaking. I'm wondering if the compromised position we put ourselves in with passwords has more to do with the lack of complexity of a password or the lack of changing up your password. Like, as you say, you have 200 passwords. You know, maybe I only have a combination of a couple different. So which is the thing that compromises us the most?
The combination is critical. You go with the first step of at least creating more than four digits, you know, more than four characters, have six or more.
Okay.
And if I use my niece's name, let's say, and I add a number one, that's just not going to do it.
No.
It needs to be complex.
Okay.
Changing them is a nice layer to have, but complex, and each of them has to be different. It's hard to remember them or to even create them.
Alain, you have 200 passwords. I've got 30 or 40. You know, everyone's got different amounts. And it certainly makes sense to have a password manager. But when you do business with a password manager company and you provide a certain level of information about yourself so that you can set up the account, how are you protected? How is the individual protected if the password management company is hacked?
That's a really good question, because a couple of the big ones that I think we all know have been hacked massively. So here's one thing, if I may explain what we do to try to add an extra layer of security.
Alain, please go ahead.
Okay, so most of the sites that you go online to buy services let you log in with your Facebook or Twitter ID. This is called single sign-on, and they use a system called OpenID. So if you do that, let's say you log in with your Facebook account, you know, you log into, it's like a key. Imagine whatever you use to log into your Facebook or Twitter or any other social media, or Google or whatnot, these are keys that open other sites. And this is for the convenience of people. But the more convenience you add, the less security you have. It's a directly related ratio. So what we do is we don't have that. We don't use what we call single sign-on. So that's one layer that already eliminates. So, for example, if I'm not going to name other competitors, but a huge one that has been compromised and 50 million people had to change their password, that's 50 with a 50, they use these social media logins. So that is not the best way to secure. That's one thing. The other thing is, so we don't do that.
You can't give us the name of that company, because we may have some listeners out there that...
Well, for example, Evernote, Dropbox, Evernote has been hacked quite a few times, and Basically, I wouldn't highly recommend that site because when sites are so popular and they make things easy for everyone, at the end you lose that security level.
Of course.
So in a digital safe, and again, I don't like to talk about our company so much, but I'm going to tell you a little bit the difference. So you mentioned about the security and how can we trust other sites. Well, we are stored in Switzerland and we obey Swiss law, which means that if I give away information about you, I will go to jail in Switzerland. But these are the kind of strict privacy laws that Switzerland has.
You seem like a nice guy. We'd hate to see you in jail.
Yeah, I wouldn't like that. Although Swiss jails could be quite nice. It's a luxury version. But I would say that, and again, there's not too many companies in Switzerland that do that. There's probably another one, and that's it. But try to go with the jurisdiction that protects privacy.
Okay.
Then try to go to a website that doesn't have these single sign-ons. I would highly recommend you don't go to those. There is a website I would recommend for people to go, and you can actually monitor all the hacking that has been done. It's a great site, and I think it's called Privacy is Beauty. I will try to find it right now as we speak. But there is a great website that shows you all the hacking live. Evernote has been hacked, Dropbox as well. I think we all know that.
Right.
Those are the big ones that people use. And the other thing besides hacking is these companies give away information because of the USA Patriot Act and the NSA, laws that we all read about every day on the paper.
Mm-hmm.
So let's say somebody has a breach with a spouse. The lawyer of the spouse can go subpoena without you knowing all your data for their case. That's at basic domestic level. At higher level, the government could want to look at something, or a corporation might use an excuse to subpoena your data. And you have no idea because they don't need to notify you. If you research online, you can see how many times, how many accounts Google and Evernote and Dropbox and, you know, these big companies give away to the government or authority, and they give away all your information. So that's a more jurisdiction legal discussion. But at a very basic security level, I would definitely not recommend going to a site that you can log in with your Facebook login or Twitter, because that exposes you right away.
Right.
I'll give you a concrete example at Dropbox. This is all public information that I'm giving you. But at Dropbox, the employees of Dropbox were hacked, I think a year ago, I forgot. Less than a year ago. And what happened is they hacked the Dropbox employees' account, and they had access to people's accounts. So this is definitely not good.
No.
So what happened is suddenly everybody, God knows how many information was stolen. Here's the website before I forget. Informationisbeautiful.net.
Okay.
So all in one word, this is an amazing site that gives you the world's biggest data breaches. So anything that has greater than 30,000 records of losses, it's a dynamic site. So you have these metrics you can click by category, by organization, the method of leaks, like Living Social, that's another social site. So all of these big social sites have been hacked. There's no questions about it. I go eBay, AOL, Adobe. Adobe had 150 million breaches. So, you know, it's dangerous. You know, at the end of the day, people are not going to use a password protection site, but I think you should. Just go to a company that is not so big in the social integration. There's us, there's less than a handful of others in the world, and make sure you try to go to a jurisdiction that respects your privacy. So that's about it, pretty much.
If you're just joining us, our guest is Alain Guillai. He's the digital security expert and CEO of the Swiss company GlobeX Data.
Before I ask my next question, let's just do a quick review. One, do not log in from a Wi-Fi hotspot. If you're going to be going to a site that is somewhat secure, you want to keep it secure, do it from the privacy of your home where you have maximum encryption. And if you don't have encryption at your home, That's not good. You have to get encrypted. If you have a problem with that, don't know how to set it up, get a friend or a neighbor that understands how to set that up, or call your carrier and make sure that your home Wi-Fi is encrypted. Number two, work with a password manager company, but don't go to one that is open and has been hacked. You can go to informationisbeautiful.net to find out who may or may not have been hacked. And three, if you're going to log in through Facebook or a Twitter account, you don't. It's too easy to do that. As Alana said, if it's easy to do, then it's easy to be hacked. And so just a quick review.
One last thing, John.
Yeah.
One last thing is we also comply with the highest encryption regulation for banking, such as PCI DSS, which is what banks use to protect your credit card. The payment card industry data security standard. And we use actually a company based in Utah called Security Metric to audit us every 90 days. And if I may give the website address, because people may go to Globex Data.
Yes.
Our company is digitalsafe.com. That's digitalsafe.com.
Exactly. Alan, I wanted to ask you, let's say I'm doing business. Let's say that I pay my bills with Bank America and I have a, you know, I pay on the internet. Everything's set up with Bank America. And one day Bank America, you know, communicates with me. They send something to me electronically and they ask me for my password. In what instances would you give them your password, and in what instances would you not, as hackers now are building these beautiful websites that look like Bank America's and Amazon's and all these other sites? How do you know if your site is good or not?
Actually, this is a really good point, which I forgot to mention. This is called phishing, and they actually go fish for your information. No bank in the world is going to email you and ask you for your password. So I get those too. Funny enough, I get them from banks I don't even do business with.
Sure.
The other day, I got something from CNN as well for some odd reason. A huge amount of phishing is done by copying PayPal as well. That was going on for years now, and now you're back. So if anyone emails you, first of all, if you get emails that you don't recognize, don't even open the attachment. If they send you a strange link or an attachment, if you do not know the sender, do not open it. Now, if you get an email from Macy's about a 20% sale, I'm sure it's legit. But if you get emails from people you don't recognize, just delete it. Don't even open the attachment. Second, these banks that you mentioned, those are all spam and they're phishing. These are hackers. And hackers are so smart. They can even get your own email information. And sometimes they send it from your email to maybe a relative of yours.
Right.
That
happened. I know a couple of people. Lately, the big trend is you get an email from one of your contacts and they're stuck traveling and they need money because they lost their wallet. That's a big one, by the way.
Yes.
I just got one a month ago like that. The funny enough is the other person is in the same city, and I was just having tea with them the other day. So I told him that, you know, you better change your email.
Yeah.
And I forgot to mention, if you go to Digital Safe, and I don't mean to do that all the time, we do provide an email account as part of the service. You can store data, share data. The password manager is just one of the services. But I use my Digital Safe email, which is encrypted and all that. So these emails you get from the bank, just delete them. I sometimes forward them to my bank, if it's from my bank, and I tell them, listen, you know, you've been compromised. So, you know, they may be able to help out.
Alan, we're unfortunately out of time. We could go on talking to you forever. But thank you so much for joining us. Alan Guy is the CEO of Globex Data, a Swiss company. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Lynn. Thanks, John.
Thank you, Alan.
And we also want to thank Professor Scott Jensen, as well as our underwriter, San Francisco Design, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties, Peak Art and Frame, and Nexus IT. It's KPCW, Park City.